The aigrette in his cap, blazing with the diamond known as the Mountain of Light, wearing a blue cloak heavy with pearls, the Shah advanced towards the peacock throne, recorded the traveller Victoria Sackville West. European women curtsied to the ground, the men inclined themselves low in his passage, the mullahs shambled forward in a rapacious proprietary wave. With his own hands, he removed the cap from his head, she wrote. With his own hands, he raised and assumed the crown. 11 years after he coronated himself in December 1924, Iran's King of Kings, center of the universe, Reza Shah Pahlavi, the son of a conservative small landowner, ordered his women subjects to remove their hijabs. The Kashf-e-Hijab decree was a critical moment in his effort to remake Iran into a modern nation with a modern military, modern railways, modern banks, modern schools, and men in European-style modern caps. Through the past week, the world has watched as dancing young women have tossed their veils into bonfires, while others defiantly cut their hair in public. A rebellion against the theocratic regime that forced women back into the hijab in 1979. At least 40 protesters have reportedly been shot dead in clashes with police, while pro-hijab vigilantes have heckled and intimidated unveiled women. Events in Iran aren't, however, just driven by women's desires for personal freedoms. You see, the hijab is a metaphor for a bitter struggle that involves identity, the state, social class, and politics. Although it's sometimes claimed Reza's decree abolishing the veil was a moment of liberation for Iran's women, their experience of westernization was unequal and very often traumatic. Like many modernizing societies, late 19th century Iran depended on the unseen labor of women. Elite women might have lived in secluded, polygamous families surrounded by children, eunuchs, and servants, but most others supported their families, working as seamstresses, carpet weavers, domestic laborers, and even sex workers. These two worlds were united, political scientist Hamideh Saidghi has observed in her superb history of Iranian politics. In seclusion, women's work, whatever it was walled away. Following a succession of military defeats, Iran's Qajar monarchs were forced into iniquitous trade treaties with Imperial Russia and Britain. Even as Iran's people struggled with the impact of these deals, King Ahmad Shah sustained the monarchy by selling lands and royal concessions, even the people, into slavery. Later in the century, Saidghi observes, women began resisting the colonial imposed order that had caused so much hardship. The mosque often provided the foundation for their efforts. Led by Zinat Pasha, armed and veiled women from the city of Tabriz led protests against a tobacco monopoly granted to Britain in 1891. Anis al-Dawleh, King Nasir ad-Din Shah's wife, is reputed to have fueled these protests. Women also played a key role in the 1906 constitutional revolution in Iran, which forced the establishment of a constitutional senate, the Majlis. King of the Muslims, women protesters told the Shah, if Russia and England support you, upon the orders of Muslim leaders, Iranians will declare a jihad against you. Following Russia's occupation of Iranian territory in 1911, the American lawyer Morgan Schuster recorded in his memoirs, 300 veiled women marched to the Majlis, armed with, and I quote, pistols under their skirts or in the folds of their sleeves. Few gains, however, flowed to women from these efforts. The 1906 constitution mandated that all laws be compliant with the Sharia and the approval of the clergy. Women were denied the vote and a role in public life. Liberal, King Reza wasn't. When his daughter Ashraf Pahlavi wrote from Switzerland to ask the new king for higher education abroad, something her twin brother was being given, she received a curt note demanding she stop this nonsense and come home. The king's interest in westernization, however, was energetic in matters that didn't involve women. He insisted the royal family stop using its hands to eat its meals and even ordered a court musician to westernize local musical tunes. In 1927, men were instructed to replace traditional hats with French caps with a brim. The king had little interest, as we saw in his letter to his daughter, in the emancipation of women. But women's bodies and the veil became a battleground for his efforts to centralize power in the crown. The process of unveiling, Sergi has perceptively noted, transferred the patriarchal power of the clergy to the state, and then the state itself assumed the role of patriarch. Things began to come to a head during the Iranian New Year festival in 1928. That March, Queen Maryam Savadkuhi visited a shrine in the holy city of Qom in what one cleric claimed was a semi-transparent chador, or what we call a burqa in India. The furious Reza, historian Hushang Chehabi has written, I quote, entered the shrine with his boots on, personally manhandled a number of seminarians and clerics, and had the cleric who had criticized the queen whipped. Later that year, men began receiving orders to follow Western attire, and police were ordered to ensure women could appear in public without a veil. The king was actually still a little bit cautious on the veil issue. During a 1929 state visit, while the progressive Afghan queen Soraya Tarzi appeared unveiled in public, Iranian Queen Maryam chose not to directly face the Afghan king. The gloves had come off though in the veil battle. In 1935, the education minister was ordered to ensure girls did not wear the veil in schools, while men were ordered to wear top hats to public functions. Efforts to enforce the hat rules in the city of Mashhad led to savage violence in 1935, which ended in the killing of over 100 protesters. But the king did not back down. The following year, he began pushing an ambitious program of gender desegregation. The impacts were sometimes tragicomic. The writer Reza Baraheni wrote that his father used to carry his mother and wife to the public bath inside pistachio sacks. Elite men faced with royal orders to host parties together with their spouses contracted temporary wives for the sacrilegious task. Even as some westernized, educated Tehran families embraced desegregation, many pious women we know from contemporary accounts experienced unveiling almost in the way nudity might be today. Elsewhere, as you can expect, police cashed in on these rules to extort money, while some ultra-conservative families even fled across the border to Iraq. Well, King Reza was dethroned by the West in 1941 for reasons unconnected with the hijab story, and his young son, Muhammad Reza Pahlavi, succeeded him. Like under his father though, there were few real gains from women. From 1944 to 1952, three efforts were made to gain women the right to vote, and each was defeated. Early in 1963, the new Shah though launched what he called the White Revolution. A plan, the New York Times gushed at the time, to lead Iran out of what it called 2,500 years of archaic stagnation. The revolution centered around a populist program of land redistribution and rapid industrialization. In one speech, the scholar Ali Ansari records, the Shah told Iranians, and I quote, that you will have smart clothes, that you will have a nice house. There was one more important promise though. The enfranchisement of the country's women. Large-scale protests broke out against the program, with clerics adroitly using the issue of women's freedoms to mobilize their conservative constituency against the Shah's white revolution. Teachers, nurses, and women employees staged counter-protests. The Shah backed them, announcing he was, I quote, done with social and political parasites, a reference, of course, to the clergy. The white revolution, though, proved mythical. Expansive military and social spending drained the treasury. Agriculture and industry were crippled by the Shah's policies. Elevated levels of employment pumped up by state loans created jobs, but those jobs couldn't compensate for stagnant living standards. A decadent multi-million dollar party thrown by the Shah in 1971 to celebrate the founding of the Persian Empire 2,500 years earlier, crystallized widespread public revulsion against the regime. For many women, the Shah's promise of liberation proved completely empty. For the most part, Saidghi has written, women workers continued to spend long hours in badly paid jobs, commuting long distances to work. Zaki Nishin, or Tehran's shantytown residents, paid almost as much in rent as they made in wages, while the conditions of carpet weavers resembled those of the 19th century. To some women, it appeared that God's order might offer salvation where this so-called westernization had failed. In 1979, women lined up to chant slogans supporting the messianic Islamist leader Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. "Death to the unveiled woman and her cowardly husband," the slogans went. "Wear a veil or have your head kicked in." The hijab had now become a potent symbol of the Islamic revolution, promising to overthrow a toxic process of westernization through sexual control of women's bodies. 4 decades on, Iran's women are protesting again, this time against a regime that runs a tyranny that rules over their sexuality and choices, but without delivering on its promises of equality and justice. The violence unleashed by hijab enforcers of the Kamiti-e-Gasht and the Amar-e-Bimaruf wa Nahi-e-Azmankar isn't without legitimacy, though. For many women, the lived experience of westernization, after all, just meant injustice and subjugation. To both its supporters and its enemies, then, the hijab isn't about personal choice. It is a symbol of fundamental political questions which have yet to be resolved by a century of struggle. I'm Praveen Swamy, and I'm National Security Editor of The Print. Thank you for watching Security Code.